Case number 14-1028 et al. World Color USA Corp., a wholly owned subsidiary of Quad Graphics, Inc., petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Holland for the petitioner, Mr. Tsai for the respondent.
Before we begin, I just wanted to thank Howard Law School very much for the kindness of allowing us to hold court today here. Also, for anyone who was thinking they were going to see a search and seizure Fourth Amendment case, we apologize. One of the lawyers got sick and went to the emergency room yesterday, so that case, unfortunately, has been put off till a week from Friday, where we'll be back at our regular courthouse. So with no further ado, I think Mr. Holland is up. Is that right?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ronald J. Holland. This is my co-counsel, Ellen Bronchetti, and we represent the petitioner in this matter, World Color. The question before the court is what legal standard should apply to the review of a non-discriminatory company uniform or dress code rule where the board offers absolutely no evidence of discriminatory or disparate enforcement of the rule, but instead seeks to find that the publication or maintenance of that rule is a Section 8A1 violation. The basic facts in the case are, for the most part, undisputed. World Color was acquired by Quad Graphics in 2010. Prior to that time, Quad Graphics had a comprehensive company-wide uniform policy that required certain articles of clothing. Prior to the acquisition of World Color, Quad Graphics implemented a cap policy. The cap policy is located in the safety section, and the cap policy requires that if an employee is attempting to secure their hair to their head, they may use a baseball cap. If they use a baseball cap, that baseball cap has to be a company cap. It has to be aligned with the uniform. If you look at the rule, you'll see in the safety section that there are several opportunities to secure your hair. You can secure your hair any way you want. You can cut it, you can use a tie, you can use a clip, or you can use a baseball cap. It's an optional piece of the uniform. The policy is simply written. Baseball caps are prohibited except for quad graphics caps with the bill facing forward. At trial, there was no evidence of disparate enforcement.
How should we view the evidence in the record that at least one employee believed that the policy prohibited the attachment of any union sticker or button to the hat?
His subjective belief, Your Honor, that the policy may have precluded that is belied by the other evidence in the record, the express written rules of the company. There's absolutely no rule in the record that prohibits adornment of the uniform or the hat in any way.
Isn't it true that the buttons and pins are prohibited on the production floor, that these employees are on the production floor?
That's not correct, Your Honor. You're referring to a separate safety rule regarding wearing jewelry and bracelets. Jewelry and bracelets are prohibited when an employee is actually engaged in production activities. The rule doesn't say that jewelry and bracelets are prohibited when you're on the floor.
Okay, let me ask you a question then. I'm reading from the transcript of your opening statement. Page 32 says, and this is your statement to the ALJ, it needs to be a company hat if you choose that method. Now, the hat is a piece of clothing. It's not a button or a pin. Buttons and pins are prohibited on the production floor because they can fall into the pieces of equipment. That is a direct quotation of yours to the ALJ. Wasn't the ALJ entitled to take that representation from the company as the company's rule?
Your Honor, I would say that the opening statement paraphrased the rule. The rule explicitly was put into evidence as a part of the employee guidelines and also as part of our exceptions brief. And the rule regarding jewelry and bracelets is narrowly construed to only preclude those such items when the employee is engaged in production activities.
Frankly, it has no bearing on patches, right?
Has no bearing on patches, Your Honor. It has no bearing on stickers. It has no bearing on other items that an employee would use to adorn the hat or the uniform. There's absolutely no prohibition in the record or in the company policies that would prohibit adornment of the uniform.
But you're not saying there is any evidence in the record that you could do that. Is that right? It seems to me all of your statements are very careful about no evidence in the record in the other way. Are you representing that the company's policy is such that you could stitch onto the company hat a union logo, a bigger one on top of the employer logo?
Well, there are two items that I'd like to address. One is there's a specific policy that because it's part of the uniform, you're not permitted to cover the actual company logo. What you're asking is if an employee could affix something permanently to the hat as opposed to a button or a sticker. If I have to proceed that far, there is a difference between I would say generally not. The employee is not permitted to actually sew a patch on the shirt or the pants. Mm-hmm. With regard to the hat, as Your Honor knows, it's an optional piece of the uniform. It's an optional piece of the uniform that employees may purchase. Technically, that hat is their property. And so there's no limitation on what they can do with their own property other than for safety reasons.
So your answer is yes, they can sew a union label on a hat?
I would say that issue is not before the court.
We know it's not, but answer the question.
I would say that there's no policy specifically permitting or specifically prohibiting the sewing of a patch on the baseball cap.
So it's not reasonable to read the rule as requiring a hat that has only the sewn in insignia of the company?
No, it's not reasonable to read the rule that way. The fact is that it requires a cap with the logo. It doesn't say with only the company logo, and then there's no further prohibition on what you can adorn the uniform or the hat with. In fact, there's a part of the uniform policy that talks about accessorizing the uniform. And so if we agree that the hat and the pants and the shirt are part of the uniform, the accessorizing in good taste would allow the employee to accessorize the uniform in any way they see appropriate.
And there's plenty of, at least if the pictures in the joint appendix are correct, the company logo occupies very little space on the hat, leaving loads of space for union logos.
That's correct, Your Honor. There are at least seven or eight types of company hat. The logo is centered in the middle. It's very small, as you can see from the pictures, approximately 2 to 3 inches in diameter. And there is plenty of room on the front of the hat or the back of the hat to apply a union sticker, to adorn the hat with union insignia or union communications to your fellow employees anywhere else other than on top of the logo.
I'm still a little stuck on the testimony and the rules about the jewelry. Aren't the employees we're talking about here people who work on the production floor? Aren't they pressmen? Isn't that right?
They're pressmen.
So are you saying that when they're operating the press, they can't wear jewelry, but they can't wear a button on their hat, but as soon as the press is turned off, the one they're operating, they can stick a button on the hat?
I would say yes, Your Honor. That's actually correct. Now, what I would
that's
say
not what you told, would that, I, that's not what you told the ALJ. So it may be that the ALJ misunderstood you, but or it may be that you overstated. But why couldn't the ALJ take as a, you know, statement of fact, your statement that buttons and pins are prohibited on the production floor?
The ALJ took the, I would say the ALJ was authorized to take the opening statement as a paraphrasing of the evidence to be submitted, but the evidence that was submitted after the opening statement that came in as a specific exhibit in the record would trump the opening statement.
But if that's a reasonable reading, assuming that you are making a reasonable reading of your own rule, which of course I would assume you would be doing, and since our rule is reasonable readings by employees, we have to go on that. Why isn't your reading a reasonable reading of the rule?
Your Honor, I would say that the reasonable reading of the rule needs to focus specifically on the rule. I use the term production floor in my opening statement. I misspoke. The specific language in the rule talks about engaged in production activities, which is a much more narrow rule than what I paraphrased in the opening statement.
I take it they can't wear any other kind of hat. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. There's evidence in the record that one, not only did there is no evidence that an employee attempted to wear a union hat, but in one instance, the government offered a witness who came in with a Green Bay Packers hat and was instructed to.
Oh, no, I don't mean that. You can't wear a hat other than a baseball hat. You can't wear any other kind of hat either.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Even though the rule only speaks about baseball hats. So we know that the actual scope of the rule is broader than the express words of the rule.
Well, I would say that the rule, again, the framework of the analysis here is the rule itself. The 8A1 framework brings us back to Lafayette Park and Lutheran Village, and the analysis is the rule as written overbroad on its face? And so to ask whether the rule itself prohibits any other type of cap, I would say the rule itself as written does not.
Well, but we know that the rule as applied by the company says no other hats because Nancy Ott filed a declaration saying, she's your HR person, that no other hats, all other hats are prohibited. So,
the rule itself does that. Baseball caps are prohibited. Well, that's true. I guess the rule explicitly is just within the universe of baseball caps and prohibits a set of baseball caps.
I don't mean to be technical about the reading of the rule. However, the rule itself, which is the one before the court, is written in such a way that it specifically prohibits baseball caps. It doesn't specifically prohibit.
It does, but the evidence in the record of your own HR person is that it bars all other hats. The board isn't limited only to the words of the rule. It's to the policy that you're applying. Otherwise we wouldn't know anything else at all.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. I would agree with your interpretation. However, I would say that the issue before the court is whether the requirement that the baseball cap be a company cap, and the analysis that applies is the issue presented, and the wearing of other caps is more akin to the question of can you wear other items of clothing? Could you accessorize your uniform? And so, again, I'd have to come back to the rule as written and say it's narrowly drafted, narrowly drawn, and that the analysis that applies would be specifically focused on the wording of the rule itself. The board offered no evidence of preclusion of other hats at trial.
Well, it did. It put into evidence an exhibit of Ms. Ott's declaration, which says no other hats.
That's true. At the end of trial, counsel for the general counsel submitted portions of the position statement that was filed with the board earlier. I don't have Ms. Ott's declaration in front of me. I, of course, trust Your Honor's reading of it and don't dispute that.
What do you say about the Coca-Cola case?
The Coca-Cola case, Great Plains Coca-Cola, involved the prohibition of an employee wearing a union jacket and a union hat. In that particular case, there was no evidence of a pre-existing uniform rule or dress code.
They were told that only Coca-Cola jackets could be worn. That's what it said. So there obviously is a Coca-Cola jacket, and they were told only Coca-Cola jackets can be allowed. And the board said it's unlawful absent special circumstances. The board treats articles of clothing the same as a button.
Well, this whole article of clothing and union buttons is conflated by the board. I mean, if you go back to the original decision from 1988, Max Supermarkets, which was issued by the ALJ at issue in this case, it had to do with a situation during an election campaign where there was no uniform or dress policy at all, and employees started wearing caps. And in the middle of the organizing campaign, a rule was issued saying no caps. And Judge Cates found that the special circumstances analysis should apply because you were eliminating union insignia in the workplace.
I'm not sure. The import of what you're saying is that they've been making mistakes since then in their own rule? I mean,
no,
Coca-Cola case is from 1993.
Correct, Your Honor, and if I may get to that.
Yeah.
The Coca-Cola case, again, has to do with the enforcement of a uniform policy where there is, by a supervisor, where there's no evidence of a written, narrowly drafted uniform policy or dress code. The supervisor says, you can only wear a Coke uniform. We don't know what that written policy looks like. We don't know whether there was a rule regarding jackets. We don't know whether there was a pre-existing rule regarding hats.
Whatever the rule was, it was applied off-site.
It was applied off-site to that particular individual, correct?
Not the jackets rule. The hat rule was off-site. The jackets rule is under a section entitled Instructions Employees Not to Wear Union Insignia at the Facility.
Correct, Your Honor. And we don't know whether there was a rule that said, along with the underlying uniform, employees are required.
We don't know that, but there's nothing in the case to suggest it's limited to the circumstances you're saying. I appreciate you could, if you were a member of the board, you could distinguish it in that way, but none of the reasoning of that case says anything about that.
Well, in fact, Member Schomburg in his dissent in the Stabilis case does exactly what I'm doing here. In the dissent in the Stabilis case, Member Schomburg says you can't rely on the Coca-Cola case because there's no finding of fact that there was a pre-existing uniform or dress code policy in effect at the time. And so Member Schomburg in that dissent rightfully says that the special circumstances test does not apply where there's a pre-existing non-discriminatory uniform policy or dress code.
Well, what he says, though, in his dissent, he agrees that special circumstances are required. That you have to show them where the employer has a uniform policy that prohibits employees from adding union insignia to the required attire. Right? That's what I'm reading you from his dissent. And he says that is okay. And this is not required attire. The hat is not required. In fact, you say it about four times in your brief that it's optional. So even under Schaumburg's dissent in Stabilis, you don't win.
But we do, Your Honor. First, Stabilis doesn't apply the special circumstances test. The majority doesn't. The majority specifically in footnote 12 says we're not going to reach special circumstances. Even though Schaumburg says they do, the majority itself in footnote 12 says we don't rule on this case based on special circumstances. With regard to Member Schaumburg's dissent, however,
I'm having a little trouble understanding that. Where is that?
Footnote 12 of the majority's opinion.
In which case?
In Stabilis case.
Footnote 12. I only go up to footnote 11 in mine.
One second. There was a footnote 12 this morning.
Oh, no. Footnote 11 is for the dissent. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead. Footnote 11. Footnote 12. I see, because we do not rely on the judge's reasoning in this regard. But that has to do with whether there was a showing. The text of the opinion of the majority says the right to wear union insignia may not be infringed absence of showing of special circumstances. These protections have always extended to articles of clothing, including pro-union T-shirts. There's no basis in precedent for treating clothing is categorically different. And then it says an employer cannot avoid this special circumstances test simply by requiring its employees to wear uniforms or other designated clothing, thereby precluding the wearing of clothing bearing union insignia.
Yes, Your Honor.
So they do seem to require
the but No disrespect to the board, but the board's analysis in Stavelis is sloppy. I mean, the board loosely throws around the term required special circumstances with regard to the wearing of union insignia, and then takes union insignia and a T-shirt and puts them together in a set of facts that we've never seen before. Schomber points out in his dissent that the only time special circumstances has been applied by the board is in a situation where there is no pre-existing dress code or uniform policy, and the employer prohibited the employee from wearing union attire, or where there was such a policy and it was disparately enforced, or the employer prohibited the employee from wearing a button or a pin, like in Republic Aviation and a variety of the other cases that analyze pins and buttons. But never before has the board said, you have a pre-existing uniform policy, a pre-existing dress code.
Even if you're right, that's now twice, right? This is not Stavelis. We now have Stavelis as a precedent, and now we're 4 years later, and we have another opinion on the subject. But what about the Mayer? I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it. M-E-I-J-E-R case.
Meyer
case.
It says, clearly an employer may not, absent evidence of likely disruption or endangerment, prohibit the wearing of union insignia in areas not involving customer contact. And that was a case where the issue was hats and jackets with union insignia in customer areas of the store.
That was the Sixth Circuit case where the underlying board decision, if you look at the underlying board decision as opposed to the Sixth Circuit's analysis, the board actually says that hats or clothing and buttons stand on completely different footing. That's where the board actually flip-flops itself if you look at the underlying board decision. And in the, I believe it's the ALJ's finding, which the board adopts, they find that that clothing and buttons stand on different footing. And so with regard to the Meyer case, the special circumstances test is enforced with regard to the wearing of union insignia, but not in the face of a pre-existing enforced non-discriminatorily enforced uniform policy.
Gee, that's not the way I'm reading it. I'm looking at the ALJ's opinion. They say, with respect to hats and jackets, there's no violation of the NLRA to bar them in customer areas of the store. But in the one instance involving a jacket with a union insignia where he's wearing it in a non-customer area, you can't bar it because it didn't involve customer contact or other special circumstances.
My understanding of the Meyer case, Your Honor, is it's similar to the Great Plains Coca-Cola case in that while there was a uniform policy, you're correct, that uniform policy didn't specifically extend itself to the wearing of jackets. And so special circumstances was required to require a company jacket in customer areas, but outside of customer areas, the special circumstances test was unavailing because it normally would be unavailing in a warehouse situation unless there was a safety reason for it. But specifically in that case, I don't believe that there were any findings of fact with regard to the uniform policy that it extended to the wearing of jackets.
Just for interest, what's the reason for this union, this hat policy?
The reason for the hat policy?
Yeah.
The reason for the hat policy is that employees, it's a dual-purpose policy, I would say, and that is, one, employees have a need to secure their hair to the head in a variety of reasons when they're operating a printer. If they choose to do so with a cap, the testimony demonstrates that if they choose to do so with a cap, HR made the determination prior to implementation that the cap should match the uniform, then the cap should align with the uniform.
But the matching doesn't have anything to do with safety. It has to do with aligning somehow. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The matching doesn't have to do with safety. The matching has absolutely to do with alignment of the uniform. Just like many companies have rules regarding personal protective equipment and what that equipment should look like, whether it's a matching vest, whether it's a matching hard hat. One of the cases cited by the board have to do with a matching hard hat and a sticker that would go on that hat. And so it's not unusual.
So it's not a safety argument at all. It's an aesthetics argument?
The argument with regard to the uniform policy is a uniform argument or an aesthetics argument. The argument with regard to wearing the baseball cap to secure your hair to your head is actually, I don't believe that that's the issue that we're that's presented before the court.
Right.
I'm sorry, Judge Williams?
Requiring hat or other thing to keep your hair out of the machinery is a safety proposition.
Yes.
It intersects with the uniform policy, because when you solve the safety problem with an article of clothing, then the uniform policy kicks in.
That's correct, Your Honor.
This is not an area where customers are coming by as a normal matter, right?
Well, you know, the issue on and customers, we presented the case as one not requiring special circumstances. There's evidence in the record that customers do visit the facility.
As I recall, it was pretty casual, pretty uncommon.
It's based on the testimony in the record. It is the government witnesses testify that while it's common, it's not common for them to come onto the production floor.
I take it that if were raised in a proper form, a company would have reasons in terms of, you fill in the blank, for requiring a uniform for workers, period.
Well, the fact is that the uniform is a company-wide policy.
That doesn't provide a reason.
No, Your Honor, I'm going to give you the company's company-wide policy. The facilities differ in a variety of ways. Some have a lot of customer contact. Some have less customer contact. Frankly, the uniform on the record, the uniform policy applies to everybody, management and hourly employees. The Quad Blues have been around since the company originated, and the only difference between the uniform of a manager and an employee would be the color of your name. A manager's name is in yellow, an employee's name is in white. That's the only difference in the uniform.
And in the application to areas where customers don't appear, it's a notion of morale, esprit de corps.
It's a notion of we're all printers.
Well, you had an opportunity to put that evidence in if you wanted to, right? Although you took the position you didn't have to show special circumstances.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You did put in whatever arguments you had on the subject.
We put in evidence.
Gang colors, you said. You're trying to keep out gang colors.
Safety. Yes.
So if you had an esprit de corps argument, you could have put it in.
Well, that was for the cap policy. The evidence that you're referring to had to do with the cap policy, not with the overall uniform policy.
For the cap, you could have put, if you thought that was part of esprit de corps, you could have put that in. But
well, because the cap, because the uniform policy was specifically not at issue, the government conceded that the company could implement a uniform policy and on its own without more. Once the cap becomes part of the uniform policy, once that cap becomes part of the uniform policy, there's no further evidence to be offered when the government concedes that the uniform policy is lawful. So if you accept that the cap is an optional piece of the uniform, once you put the cap on and you choose to secure your hair in that manner with a company cap, that company cap is not only a safety device, but it transitions to a piece of the uniform and now fits into the company uniform policy, which is not at issue.
So you could wear a bandana, I take it, instead. Is that right?
Yes.
And it could have gang colors?
Gang colors would be a different issue. Gang colors, we would...
But it would not have to be matching colors. There's no rule barring... I'm a little confused about the point of this uniform, if you can wear a bandana of any color that you want.
You can wear a clip, Your Honor. You can wear a hair tie.
Yeah.
You asked me.
Neither of those can you see, so,
Well,
it's nice, but you can barely see that. But can you see it? Wear a bandana?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to your question because it wasn't at issue, and whether that would provide a secure way of securing your hair in a safe manner.
Well, there are lots of nylon kind of caps that people wear that are quite tight over the top of the head, made specifically for the purpose of controlling hair, but can be in any color you want.
Your Honor, I have to say I don't know the answer to that question and how the company would deal with an employee who came in wearing a skull cap, as you're of a different color with a, if you're asking me, if the employee came in with a blue skull cap with a big Teamster emblem on the top,
how would the company deal with it?
I'm glad I was able to frame that up for you, Your Honor. How the company, can I get out of it with that's not really presented before the court?
I think because it cuts six different ways.
It does.
On one hand, you could argue that it provides another outlet, but again, it seems hard to imagine that a company that's trying to prevent people from wearing any hat other than this particular hat would allow them immediately then to go ahead and wear a bandana that does everything that they don't want them to do.
I understand, and that's why it's a difficult question to answer, and that's why, our position is that the court should be viewing this narrowly the way the board has traditionally viewed this type of situation. We are talking about the mere maintenance and publication of a rule. We're talking about the board's position that that rule as written is a per se violation of the act. The board takes the position they need not show more. The language of the rule itself is overbroad. The language of itself, in and of itself, is a uniform policy or a dress code policy in and of itself. Whether you can wear other union insignia beyond that is certainly not prohibited by the rule. If it were prohibited by the rule, we might be having a different discussion. But it's specifically not prohibited by that rule.
If the let's just, if the board's decision were to stand, could Quad modify their policy to just add a sentence that says you can affix a union label or pin or sticker to your hat, except in those circumstances where you're engaging on the production line, and then you'd be able to, continue forward with the hat policy as modified?
If the board's decision were to stand, it really turns decades of case law on its head, in our opinion. You know, the case law supports the proposition from Republic Aviation through the Burger King case that an employer has a right to establish a uniform policy. The question is, can you put a button on it? And the prohibition of putting a button on it is where the board's analysis centers. Frankly, if you look at the Target case, the Target case was a case where there's a uniform policy, but it had this broad prescription on all buttons at any time, anywhere, non-work, work time, any facility throughout the country. There, the board applied the special circumstances to whether an employee needed to, whether it was proper to have an employee remove a particular button. However, in actually reviewing the rule, the board applied the Lutheran Village test. That same analysis applied in the Medco decision. In the underlying Medco decision, decision that was enforced in part and denied in part by this circuit in 2012, the underlying board decision there reviewed the language of the policy. It was an attire policy, and the attire policy didn't say you must wear a company shirt and company pants. It said you can't wear shirts with insulting, confrontational language on it, a broad prescription of union speech. The company enforced that policy. The board analyzed the enforcement under the special circumstances test, however, analyzed the rule as written under the Lutheran Village test. In Medco, the board's decision in Medco is post-Stablis. And so even the board itself, when confronted with an attire policy post-Stablis, applied special circumstances to the enforcement of the policy, but Lutheran Village to the analysis of the policy as written. And that's because special circumstances is actually a defense, right? Special circumstances is a defense. It's a rebuttal to improper or alleged unlawful conduct. The Lutheran test is the board's test in analyzing an alleged per se violation of the act. And that's the difference between the two tests. And so here, we're not put to the test of special circumstances. There was no enforcement. There was no enforcement of the policy. The proper analysis is the narrow analysis of Lutheran Village that says, is this rule likely to chill Section 7 activity? And then it goes through, has it ever been enforced to restrict Section 7 activity? Would you reasonably construe it as such? And was it implemented as a result of Section 7 activity, which it absolutely was not?
Okay, we'll hear from the board. Thank you.
Your Honor, I did intend to reserve 3 minutes and inform the clerk, but I see we went a little bit over.
All right, we'll see how generous we're feeling after the board. I think we'll probably be generous, don't worry.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, David Side for the Labor Board. At the outset, company counsel referred to several cases that I don't believe were cited in its briefs, Target, Medco, Maxis Supermarket. If the Court should desire any supplemental memo from the board, it would be happy to provide it, but I'm not prepared to discuss them before this Court this morning. There are three very short points that summarize the board's position here. First, this is simply a substantial evidence test and substantial evidence case.
Is it really? Because the board's opinion, and the ALJ did this too, seems to dispose of the main issue by saying it's undisputed. The footnote 3 says it is undisputed that the policy on its face prohibits employees from engaging in the protected activity of wearing caps bearing union insignia. And you say that's undisputed, but the exception brief of the respondent says there's no evidence that Quad prevents employees from securing their hair with devices that have union insignia on them. Instead, the policy simply prevents employees from replacing the company hat with any hat of their own choosing. So it seems to me it is disputed, and it may be that in this oral argument, great arguments for the board's conclusion have been presented, but that doesn't eliminate the proposition that it was disputed, sharply disputed.
Your Honor, the board reasonably found that the policy on its face
The board said it was undisputed, okay? In other words, there's no analysis, right, of how you get from a rule requiring hats, company hats, if you choose to wear a hat at all, to a prohibition of insignia on the hat. That step is simply treated as undisputed.
Your Honor, the rule required employees to wear a company hat.
Required them to wear a company hat if they chose to wear a hat. Right.
Which, on its face, Your Honor, precludes them from wearing a union hat.
How does it do that? Oh, a union. Do you mean a union hat? It doesn't preclude them from wearing a company hat with union insignia.
Your Honor, there's simply no evidence that the employees could have attached any other insignia to the hat.
Is there any evidence that they were barred from attaching union insignia?
Your Honor, before the board, the company introduced no evidence to indicate that.
Let's just look at the evidence of the rule, okay? Does the rule say anything about insignia?
Your Honor, the rule does not specifically state.
Okay, insignia. So, I mean, if I rent a car, I'm not supposed to, or employee is supposed to drive a company car. Does that mean he can't attach a U.S. flag to it, if you so mind it. No. Or a union flag, for that matter.
Your Honor, the company at the hearing and in its briefs has made various arguments as to other alleged insignia that possibly the employees could attach or wear. It has never made an argument in its briefs to the board that employees could attach anything to the company hat, as far as sewing something on.
It did say they could wear insignia. It doesn't prevent them from securing their hair with devices that have union insignia on them.
Your Honor, the only thing that was mentioned in the company's rule is the ability to attach possibly a hairnet. And whether or not employees could be creative and make that hairnet into a union hairnet, the board
let's
doesn't...
Let's not worry about hairnets. Let's talk about hats. The hat policy seems to say nothing about insignia.
Your Honor, it doesn't need to specifically restrict the union insignia. It doesn't have to say that. Is this court recognized
in Guardsmark, Judge Tatel laid out a sort of orderly approach to these matters, starting with first question, what does the rule explicitly do? And it appears that the board here read the stop there in the analysis, mistakenly claiming that the rule explicitly bars attachment of insignia. There's no effort to apply the various subsequent steps that Judge Tatel lays out.
Your Honor, the only things that the company had argued as far as that it made an argument in its reply brief that employees could wear earrings, although the actual evidence shows that they could not wear earrings and the jewelry was prohibited. It made an argument actually about in its briefs about pins and buttons, although not just at the opening statement but also in its brief in support of exceptions to the board, specifically stated that that pins and buttons could not be worn. It is never asserted that something can be attached to the hat as far as the union insignia being sewed on.
Can you point me to any case from any court or a board decision where there was a conclusion that there was a facial violation because you had to wear a company uniform and the court or the board concluded that that meant that you couldn't affix any union button to the uniform?
Yes, Your Honor, there are two cases. For example, in the Albertsons case and the PSK Supermarkets case, those were both cases where the employer had a policy that prohibited badges or pins except either for a name or for something that the employer would allow the employees to wear. That was considered to be on its face prohibiting union pins.
That's saying it's prohibiting badges or pins except for a particular type of pin. So obviously that prohibits a union pin or anything that's not designated. My question is different. If it says that you have to wear a company hat, but it doesn't say anything about pins, what case has any court or the board ever said we have to assume that that means you can't attach a union pin to it?
Your Honor, there have been a number of cases where an employer has a policy and then there's been a situation where an employee has tried to wear a union, whether it be a jacket or a hat or a button, and depending on particular circumstances, it's been allowed or disallowed. Generally,
but that hasn't.
And those are all discriminatory enforcement cases, and this isn't a discriminatory enforcement case.
Your Honor, it's a situation where there might be an application, but it's still the policy itself that's called into question. It's not just that it's discriminatorily applied; it's ultimately the policy itself that's being called into question. The ability for the employer to require employees to wear, whether it be an employer shirt or employer hat.
Well, then why shouldn't we wait and see if this is how this is applied before concluding that the policy is discriminatory rather than saying, well, on its face it is.
Because as this court recognized in the Guardsmart case, if something is facially overbroad, it does not require a specific application.
Yeah, but it breaks it down into explicitly overbroad, and I have to say, and I think ordinary users of English wouldn't see that applicable here, or reasonably interpreted by an employee to have an overbroad meaning. And the board never even reached that, so I don't, the board simply declared it undisputed.
Correct. The board did not view this as a Lutheran Heritage case.
Where, a little louder or in
sure.
Boring.
The board, that is correct. The board does not view this as a Lutheran Heritage case where, for example, maybe there's a policy that requires employers to wear hats consistent with the company's goals and objectives, and then there would be a situation where would employees reasonably interpret that
rule? So you're saying the board did, in fact, rely on the first step laid out in Guardsmart.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. It regards a prohibition of non-company hats as explicitly barring attachment of any insignia to such hats. Is that a correct summary of the board decision here?
Your Honor, I don't understand or appreciate the company's argument as ever suggesting that in requiring employer hats, that employees had an option of affixing something to that.
Well, they do explicitly say that there's nothing in the policy that prevents attachment of insignia. So, but the board says it's undisputed that attachment of insignia was barred.
Your Honor, and the company, again, in its briefs, was referring to things like headbands and pins and earrings, not sewing a insignia onto the hat.
Well, where do you get that? I mean, it appears to be a general declaration that there's nothing about the policy, which I think fits ordinary reading, nothing about the rule that prohibits attachment of insignia.
Your Honor, respectfully, the board simply viewed it differently.
Well, but the board, if we're in the first step of Guardsmart, has to point to explicit language. I don't see it.
And I understand the court's concerns. The board simply viewed it differently than on its face, a policy that if employees chose to wear a cap, that it had to be a company cap.
That's correct. But that doesn't say that it's a company hat barren of any additional insignia.
What about the council's representation that insignia can't be attached on the production while somebody's on the production floor?
Your Honor, if I understood, company council wasn't quite clear or seemed to indicate that he didn't think that an employee would be able to sew an insignia on.
Aren't there employees we're talking about here, people who are involved in production? That's what they do, right?
Well, that's correct.
They're not like sometimes doing production and sometimes not, right?
Your Honor, I don't know how their time breaks down, but as referenced in the company's brief in support of its exceptions at page 17, which is in the board's brief, the company specifically states that there are legitimate safety policies such as no pins or buttons on the production floor. It doesn't indicate simply when machines may be running. It says no pins or buttons on the production floor that could potentially fall into equipment.
Which page are you looking at now?
This is page 17, Your Honor, of the brief in support of exceptions, and it is cited in the board's brief and was lodged with the court.
So let's suppose we were to let the board's decision stand. Could the company amend their policy by adding a sentence that says you can attach a union insignia with a sewed-on label or ironed-on label to the hat? and then the policy would be could be re-implemented?
Your Honor, I can't specifically give a definitive answer because should this court enforce the board's order, it would go to compliance with the board's regional office. But arguably, if there is a demonstrated viable option that in addition to whatever company insignia is required, that employees can attach insignia to the hat, that is arguably a viable solution, but I can't state with definite certainty.
Can I ask you about NLRB's law on this subject? So, because there would be, imagine that their rule was that, in fact, you could stitch a union label above, in front. I mean, they made the rule sort of specifically says you have to have the bill of the cap in front, and the company's logo is in front. But assuming there's room for a union label there, imagine they said you could either put a large union button on the front as well, or stitch in a union label. I assume there'd be two possible theories here. One is that's good enough, and that the board's law would say that's good enough. And the other is that that's not good enough, that it's up to the employee to decide how they want to communicate their union support, not up to the employer. Which of these two propositions does NLRB law support, or is the second one not yet decided?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that they're decided, but there are, and again, the board doesn't look at this as a uniform case, but there are board cases where an employer has a uniform policy, and then there are issues about employees adding buttons or adding something to the uniform, and that can, depending on the circumstance, be lawful by adding a button.
So the case might be different if the facts were, and it might be different in the board's view if the facts were that you could adorn your hat with the union label. Is that right?
Your Honor, and I see that my time is up, but yes, arguably it could be different.
We let him go 15 minutes over. I don't think you're anywhere near close yet.
Yes. I mean, the board doesn't pick and choose between union insignia, and obviously there are Section 7 rights that underpin the Act, but in uniform cases, that is the balance that is made between an employer's policy that sets forth certain requirements and generally an employee's ability to add something to that uniform.
But the board has language suggesting that from a Section 7 point of view, there's no difference between insignia and jackets or shirts. And that seems to pretty much eliminate employer ability to choose a uniform, or at least to put a heavy burden on them to justify any such requirement.
Your Honor, the board cases have applied a special circumstances test regardless of the type of case involved.
But the special circumstances test seems very elastic. At least I haven't encountered anything where the board spells out how the special circumstances test works out. What is it, a balancing test? Is it you have to meet some particular heavy burden of showing that the policy is okay? There's total obscurity on that.
Your Honor, the board has set forth special circumstances. It can be a variety of things. It could be the type of contact.
There's no overarching principle that ever seems to have been stated.
Your Honor, the board has set forth a variety of factors, that it could be the type of contact that one has with the public. It could be for production and discipline issues. There can be, the board's brief does cite and go through and list, I think, at least six factors or so that the board can consider. And no one is disputing in this case, and although the company isn't seriously claiming that it set forth evidence of special circumstances, the board isn't disputing that had the company set forth sufficient evidence that things like security and gang activity could have arguably been a sufficient special circumstance. It just wasn't shown in this particular case.
But didn't the board also say that the result would be the same even if we accepted the argument that the cap policy is part of the uniform policy?
That is correct, Your Honor. This court doesn't have to reach that alternative holding. In the board's view, the cap policy was simply not part of the uniform policy. It was an optional policy that was primarily being done for safety reasons, and so it doesn't need to address any issues that this court might be concerned about an employer's ability to set forth a uniform policy, but that this in and of itself stands alone from that, and the board and this court doesn't need to reach that alternative holding.
So you're not defending that alternative holding?
Your Honor, the board's position is that the result would be the same, that the board still would properly apply the special circumstances test, but on the facts of this case, the cap policy was not part of the uniform policy, and there's substantial evidence to support that finding.
Isn't it clear as an analytical matter that the cap policy, at a minimum, intersects, overlaps with the uniform policy? In other words, it is a policy with respect to clothing. It happens to be expressed in a part of the rules relating to safety, but it can't be unusual for the board to confront two sets of rules which intersect, so that a classification, they must be one or they must be the other, becomes completely arbitrary.
Your Honor, on the facts of this case, not only were the uniform policy and the cap policy set forth in two very distinct sections of the employee guidelines, with the testimony from the Human Resources Director Ott, she acknowledged that this was done and that it was placed in the safety section because this was considered a safety issue. And yeah, when it comes to covering hair,
still the actual language of the rule, which is framed in terms of a clothing policy, right? That seems to overlap with the explicit clothing policy.
Your Honor, again, all as board counsel, I can state that the board reasonably found on the evidence in this case, not just in how it's set forth in the manual from Human Resources Director Ott's testimony.
It's a matter of evidence, a matter of analysis. It's a matter of what the words mean.
And, Your Honor, it's also a matter of how it even gets presented to the employees. When it gets presented to the employees in a question and answer, it's set forth as two very distinct, a uniform policy regarding a shirt and pants, and then there's safety policies and there's safety issues, one of which includes mechanisms to cover your hair, of which a hat is an optional manner of doing that.
Why is it a reasonable construction of a rule that says, when you're at work, you have to wear company-issued shirt, pants, and hat? Let's say that's all that the policy said. Why would it be a reasonable construction, or would it be a reasonable construction of that to say, I can't put any kind of a pin, union or otherwise, on my uniform, if that's all that the rule said?
Your Honor, if that's all that the rule said, and that's not in this case where the company acknowledges these are production employees and they cannot add those types of things to the shirt or hat.
But I'm asking you, if that's all the rule said, would it be reasonable to construe it as saying, to interpret it that you couldn't put a pin on either your hat or your shirt or your pants? I'm sorry, a pin on your hat, shirt, or pants.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. That would still raise issues whether the policy itself would be lawful and whether circumstances were shown to justify those limitations with respect to a hat, a shirt, and pants. But it wouldn't necessarily, on its face, restrict the ability to add a button. Again, the board doesn't choose between types of protected activity.
So what about the language of the policy here makes it reasonable for us or an employee to construe that they could not affix a union hat? Just looking at the words of the policy.
Your Honor, the words of the policy that if an employee wears a hat, that it needs to be a company hat with the company insignia is reasonably construed as limiting and preventing employees from wearing union hats.
I'm not asking about union hats. I'm asking about a union sticker on your company hat. why would it be reasonable for someone to conclude just from reading those words that they couldn't do that?
Your Honor, on the facts of this case, just from that rule, it wouldn't, except there is evidence to indicate that employees cannot put things such as pins
on. Their choice not to put them on says nothing about the meaning of the rule. They didn't testify that they read the rule as barring insignia, right?
Your Honor, again,
there's no testimony to that effect, right?
Your Honor, there is one employee that the board does acknowledge. The board is not treating this as a Lutheran Heritage case where the board examines how employees would evaluate the rule, whether it was in response to union activity and whether there's been actual enforcement. The board does acknowledge this is not a Lutheran Heritage case.
I'm a little confused by something you said earlier. The board doesn't choose between methods of communication. So this is the question I began asking you, which you demurred. Now, are you no longer demurring? That is, I asked, the board might be taking the position, I frankly can't tell, but might be taking the position that a union hat is like, it's in whole, is like a union button. And the board can no more tell an employee that they can't wear a union hat than they can tell an employee that they can't wear a union button unless there are special circumstances. Now, is that the board's view? Is that your view of what they did here? Or what?
Your Honor, the board has not drawn any distinction between types of union insignia, whether it's a button, a hat, or a shirt, which would imply that the board treats the insignia as having a fundamental right to wear a union button or a union shirt or a union hat absent special circumstances.
So that absent special circumstances, a company policy saying, I mean, you seem to be saying it, you must wear the company uniform is invalid, even though it explicitly says attach insignia as you like.
Your Honor, and that's why I indicated this court doesn't need to reach the board's footnote, because to my knowledge, the board hasn't, though it is said that an employer cannot hide behind a uniform policy, in other words, it can't use a uniform policy to prohibit union insignia absent special circumstances, to my knowledge, there hasn't been a case dealing with, say, production employees. Obviously, there have been cases dealing with the public, where the board has specifically addressed just the mere right of an employee to have a uniform policy absent special circumstances. All of its cases indicate that there need to be special circumstances.
It's definitely the case that an employer could not say without special circumstances, you must wear a uniform, and the only kind of button you can wear is buy at Bob's. That is, assuming the employer is Bob's, right? You the board would say you can't have a rule that says that, because that inherently bars you from having a union button, unless you are an outward-facing employee who faces the public, and somehow having buy Bob's is important, or unless buttons are, you know, if there's a security problem with buttons or anything else, right? Under those circumstances, the board would say you need special circumstances, right?
That's correct. That would be something like the Albertsons or PSK.
Yes, and that's why my question is a hat the same as a button in that context? And the answer is, I mean, you could certainly read the Coca-Cola case, the Mayer case, and the Stavlis case as saying a piece of clothing is the same in that circumstance as a button. Now, one of the special circumstances might be that those get so big, just like a big button gets so big, that it detracts from the uniform aspect in the sense for a public-facing employee. Or maybe there's an argument like Judge Williams made about sort of esprit de corps about the team, but we don't have those arguments here. But is your understanding of these cases, the clothing cases, as being essentially a hat is a button. I don't know what the answer is. This is not a trick question.
And I understand, and it's one of those things where I wish I could give the court a perfect answer. I think it is the latter, that the court, that the board, excuse me, is treating the different types of union insignia as being equal. A button and a hat and a shirt all stand as union insignia, and certain special circumstances need to be shown that would allow limitations. I'm not aware of any case where an employer has argued that there could be additions or substitutions, again, like sewing something onto a hat here. It's not clear to me that was ever fully argued to the board here, and whether the board would permit that, as opposed to simply saying that there needs to be a special circumstance to justify having the ability to exclude union hats in general. I can't give a perfect answer to this court, but I suggest that that wouldn't be a reasonable interpretation for the board's cases, where it has essentially equated all types of union insignia.
Further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Since now you both went over almost 15 minutes, we will give you a little rebuttal, but let's start by seeing if you can just answer our questions. Maybe that's the best way to do that. So imagine that I thought that a lot does depend on whether this is disputed or undisputed about whether or not attachments could be made to the hat. Are you representing that if we were to send it back, we were to say there has to be fact-finding on this question, that the company would say that you can stitch things onto the hat, that these workers can put stickers on the hat, that these workers could put buttons on the hat, or is what's going to happen is it's going to go back and the company's going to say, no, you can't do any of those things? Is there a representation that it would be useful in any way to send it back? Because as I said, all of your briefing is all about the absence of evidence. So if we send it back, you wouldn't be able to just say there's an absence of evidence. If we send it back on this theory, the board would have, through an ALJ, would have to take evidence about whether or not there can be these adornments.
That's correct, Your Honor. If you were to send it back, there'd have to be an evidentiary hearing. But if the court were to agree that the Lutheran Village analysis applies, there's actually no reason for remand.
I'm not saying if we take your view of the law, because then you win regardless. I'm saying if we thought it might make a difference to the board whether or not there were attachments, are you telling me that you would put in evidence that you couldn't attach things to the obviously, that's not evidence here, but it makes a difference about whether this is a useful thing to do or not.
We would put into evidence, if it were remanded under that hypothetical, if it were remanded for that purpose, we would have to put in evidence regarding whether items could be attached. I will tell you, from my personal knowledge of the facility, that I don't know whether there is such evidence, in the sense that I don't know whether employees actually attempt to adorn their uniform in any sort of way.
Well, I'll put it another way. HR person, Ms. Ott, when put on the stand and asked the question, employees would like to know, because otherwise they're not going to do it because they don't want to risk violating the policy. Employer can't have a policy that says, hey, we're not going to tell you whether you can attach a button. And when you do, then we're going to announce that you can't, right? That would clearly not be okay.
That would not be okay. Right.
So the question would be to the head of HR or anybody else who runs this policy, before employees risk their job by putting a union adornment on their hat, they want to know whether they can. Can they? Is there a prospect that the answer would be yes? Or is it clear that, or is it that the answer would be no?
No, Ms. Ott would testify that compliant with federal law, that employees could attach items to their uniform, including the hat. I mean, she would testify.
When you say compliant with federal law, you mean compliant with your view that they can't put that on?
No, no, that's not my view, Your Honor. No,
I don't mean you personally.
I understand, and obviously she wouldn't say compliant with federal law unless I prepped her really well.
Yeah.
She would say yes, of course you can adorn the uniform, and if general counsel would say, well, are there restrictions on the adornment of the uniform? She would get into, this is a printing company, and there's heavy machinery, and to the extent that there were prescriptions.
That wouldn't apply to stickers or...
No, it doesn't apply to stickers. It doesn't. No, that's correct, Your Honor.
So, in other words, she might say that you can put a sticker, or I'm not sure why a sticker is any better than a button from the safety point of view. If that falls in the machine, that's not good either. But
one's paper, one's metal. And
I understand. So she might say that a sticker or a stitched-in insignia would be okay?
Can we break these down into permanently affixing something to the hat and attaching a button or a sticker?
Yeah, you can break it down any way you want.
But there is a difference. There's a distinct difference. You know, since we're discussing it, if you look at UPS or a UPS uniform, they have a relationship with the Teamsters where they've agreed to allow them to literally stitch a patch on company-owned uniforms. If you're asking, would Ms. Ott agree that you can stitch a patch of whatever you like onto your company uniform, I'm not sure she would agree that you could permanently affix such a patch on your company uniform. It alters the nature or the character of the uniform. If you asked her, could you affix a removable item to your uniform, and we're talking about the uniform, the lower half, not the upper half right now, a button or a sticker or some other item, I'm certain that she would say, yes, you could. And the same would go for the hat, although the hat is, again, the hat's slightly different in that the company either rents the uniforms to the employees or buys them for them. The hat the employee buys himself if he chooses to use a hat as an optional item to secure his hair. And so, but bringing this full circle, Ms. Ott would testify, yes, you can adorn the hat and you can adorn the uniform. And then she would be subject to cross-examination as to whether that adornment is regulated or restricted or unrestricted. If I may, Your Honor, though,
I just ask.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Now I'll give you one wrap-up point.
One wrap-up point.
Yeah. Since you've now had 4 minutes for the rebuttal, which is gives you 20. So make your best point here.
My best point. If there have been several questions, if we allow the decision to stand, what happens? And I think Judge Williams' point on the heavy burden that an employer would bear in a situation where it implemented for legitimate, lawful, non-discriminatory reasons, a uniform policy. Whether the individuals have contact with the public or not, if the individuals have contact with the public, you're in a better position to establish the so-called special circumstances test, although the board admonishes that mere contact with the public is not enough to establish special circumstances. If you don't have contact with the public, you could never have a dress code or uniform policy. You could never require that employees wear a particular piece of clothing without first establishing special circumstances.
Well, you might have that if we're only talking about optional clothing. So the board might say, yes, you're right with respect to required uniforms, but this is not a required element. This is an optional element, and so the rule might be different for that.
It might be, but I think that the optional nature is, frankly, a red herring. The board consistently acknowledges that minimal limitation, minimal prescription on an employee's ability to wear union insignia or to communicate union views in the workplace is proper. Here, the company has said, if you choose to wear a hat, you don't have to wear a hat. If you choose to wear a hat, it needs to match the uniform. There's no prescription on adornment. There's no prescription on employee communication. There's no prescription on language on the hat. And so the optional nature of the hat actually falls right into board law that we're permitted, if necessary, in order to match the hat with the uniform, to prescribe replacing the hat with a union hat. If we went further, no pins, no buttons, no adornment, no writing on the hat, if we went further, now we have a problem because we're severely limiting employee communication and speech regarding union sympathies in the workplace. But again, that's not the issue presented to the court. The issue presented to the court is the narrow way that the cap policy is written and the narrow way that the cap policy is written.
Further questions? All right. Thank you very much. We'll take this matter under submission. Call the next case.